Welcome to the third of a five-part series on King Records, produced for September 2016's King Records Celebration in Cincinnati. I'm Lee Hay. During this hour, you'll hear two interviews about Roy Brown conducted by music historian Brian Powers. The first interview is with John Brovin and the second with Tony Collins. You'll also hear from Roy Brown himself, an interview from the John Brovin Collection at the Library of Congress, plus many of the songs for which he's remembered.
My name is John Brovin, and I first met Roy Brown in Los Angeles in 1975 when I conducted what turned out to be the first in-depth interview of Roy Brown's great history.
Well, John, before we get into meeting Roy Brown, can you tell us first how you discovered Roy Brown's music?
I wrote my first book, Walking to New Orleans, which then was released over here in the United States as Rhythm and Blues in New Orleans. I wrote the book in 1974, and what I did was to document the history of the New Orleans Rhythm and Blues era from about 1945 to the early 1970s. And it was quite clear to me that Roy Brown was a crucial character in the New Orleans music history. And that's when I really started to delve into his back catalog, buying up a lot of his deluxe 78s and so on. Roy did, in fact, have two records released in England around about 1957 on the London American label. The first one was Saturday Night, a record which he hated, and the other one was Party Doll, which was a cover of the Buddy Knox number one hit. But neither of those Roy Brown records meant a thing. So they're now, of course, highly collectible and cost a lot of money if you can find them. But apart from that, there was certainly nothing released on Roy when he was at his peak in the late 40s, early 50s. And it was only in the rock and roll era when we had those two London American 45s and 78s. And that was it, until the reissue period came in the 1970s.
Well, when you were trying to find his music, his recordings, how hard was that to do that in the UK?
It wasn't too difficult, simply because his deluxe records appeared quite frequently on record auctions. And at that time, he wasn't, if you like, shall I say, a key character or perceived to be a key character. So in other words, it was quite easy to pick up those records for a dollar or so. And it was because I was, as I say, interested in his back catalogue that I started to pick up certainly the hit recordings that were released by Deluxe and then by King.
Now, eventually you met and interviewed Roy Brown. I was wondering, how did you go about trying to connect with him?
Well, my New Orleans book, Walking to New Orleans, was published in England in 1974, and it was published by Blues Unlimited, the magazine. And then in June 1975, my friend James LaRocca, who had been living in New Orleans, had moved out to Los Angeles, and so he and his wife, Anne, invited me out to L.A. And I thought I'd take advantage of that by trying to interview some of the old rhythm and blues artists, still with a New Orleans connection. And so I was able to interview the great drummer, Earl Palmer, the singer, band leader, Joe Jones, who did You Talk Too Much. Very pleased to have interviewed Paul Gayton, who was very influential in New Orleans when Roy Brown first started. And somehow or another, I found out that Roy was living in the Los Angeles area and made the phone call. And I can still remember this day, sort of first time I met him. And he was very friendly, very jovial, just very pleased that somebody was interested in his past history.
Where did you meet him when you first met him?
That was in Los Angeles. It was quite near where James and Anne had their apartment, which was just off of Sunset Strip. And so Roy actually came to us, and it was at the time when tape recorders were just becoming popular. And so I was able to record the interview to tape. And I have to say that it was subsequently published in Blues Unlimited, and it was one of the most well-received articles I think I've ever written.
So what were your impressions of Roy Brown when you first met him?
He was very friendly, very jovial. At that time, he would have been around about 55. Of course, that the first thing he told me was that he was born in 1925, and told every other interviewer he was born in 1925, but it wasn't until his marriage certificate turned up years and years later that we found out that he was actually born in 1920, and he wasn't born in New Orleans either. He was born in a little town called Kinder, Louisiana, which was in the middle of the sugarcane farms. But having said that, that was one of the few inaccuracies which Roy obviously wanted to convey, but it's one of the few inaccuracies in the interview. He really did have almost like a photographic memory, and I think this is why the article was so well received. The other thing I think it's well worth pointing out is when you interview artists of the stature of Roy, it's incumbent upon the interviewer to do his or her homework. And so I was able to convey to Roy that I was aware of his history on record. And so it was very free-flowing, very enjoyable interview.
Well, I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, September 10th, 1927. And most people think I'm older because my first record was 47. I was only 19 then.
Yeah.
But I was born in New Orleans. My mother was a choir director and organist. My father was a pastor, a cement finisher. You know, we traveled quite a bit in those days. And I remember we left New Orleans following my dad's work into a little town called Eunice, Louisiana. And I remember I attended elementary school there. Grade school, and I had aspirations of becoming a singer. I did most of my singing in the church at that time. And I remember I organized a quartet, a spiritual quartet, when I was only 13. And I recall we were doing some original tunes. I had written the spirituals. I had a knack for writing for somebody. I guess it was a gift. Anyway, I recall one night we did a thing called Satan's Chariots Rolling By. And man, oh man, I had about, I guess, 6 or 8 ounces of blackberry wine. And my boys and I, we got in the church and we started singing. And we started doing things we'd never done before. The sisters started clapping their hands and patting their feet. We could hear the amens, and they were shouting, amen, amen, you know, and we had them rolling, you know. And I was so very proud because my mother was there. John, when I got home, my mother didn't say anything on the way home. We had to walk about a mile and a half back to our residence from the church. When I got home, she says, okay, she said, take off your clothes. John, I knew what that meant. That meant a whipping, because she didn't get to me often, but there was a peach tree growing at the front steps. And she said, get out of your clothes and get me a few limbs. I said, well, Mommy, what did I do? She said, I'm going to teach you to jazz up spiritual. I said, what do you mean jazz? I didn't even know what she's talking about. She said, that wasn't a spiritual you were singing. I don't know what it was, but it wasn't a spiritual. And John, she just ripped me apart. But I guess at that day and age, I had the rhythm, you know, and I got it. I got it from her. I mean, she was a singer, you know. But anyway, to make a long story short, I think that was my first you might say, the inception of my doing rhythmic things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I recall after that, John,
At that time, Roy, then, there was a very strict division between blues music and spiritual music.
Well, I really believe that, well, blues is naturally a derivative from spirituals, because I can recall, I hear things right now. I mean, what catapulted Ray Charles to fame was things he'd done, other quartets had done, you know, in the church. And Ray merely substituted lyrics. I recall his "I Got a Woman." That was a spiritual. There's a man taking names. It must be Jesus. You know, I remember I used to sing it myself. But anyway, what I'm saying is, there's a very close relationship between spirituals, rhythm and blues, and also some aspects of jazz too. But I really believe that the black artist, most of us, the late Dinah Washington, for instance, and I could just go on and on and on, we began our singing career in the church, you know? And I'd like to go on a little farther, if I may.
Yes, sure. Please,
my
sure.
mother died. I entered high school in Houston, Texas, and my mother died when I was 14. And I didn't want to live anymore, you know. I didn't finish high school. I started to work, and I wanted to sing. And I came out here to L.A. later when I was about 17, and I turned professional fighter for a while. I had 18 pro fights. I won 16, too, by the way.
What sort of weight did you?
Well, I was weighing 143 pounds. I was a welterweight, you know. And I could hit because I came up in the cotton fields, the sugar cane fields. I had developed strong arms, you know. But I couldn't stand the sight of blood. It nauseated me. And when the opposition discovered this fact, they would give their boys a ketchup capsules, you know. If the fight was going my way, they'd just bite down on the capsule, let the blood trickle down the side of their mouth, and I'd just keep away from, you know, and I'd lose the fight. So my manager said, get out of it before you get killed, because it's not for you. So then I entered an amateur contest right here at Third and Broadway, a $1 million theater. And I knew at this time I wasn't singing the blues, mind you. I was imitating Crosby. He was my favorite singer, still is. I remember I had two songs, San Antonio Rose and a thing called I Got Spurs That Jingle, Jangle, Jingle. It was the only two.
I got
spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle as I go riding merrily along. Well, anyway, I did those two songs and I won first prize. And John, I was behind with my room rent at a hotel on Main Street. I was paying $2.50 a week. And I was 6 weeks behind. As a matter of fact, they had evicted me, but I would slip up the fire escape and sneak into my room and get up real early the next morning, make up the bed as best I could, and sneak out down the fireplace and fire escape again. But when I won this first prize, it was $60. Man, I made a beeline to a hot dog stand. I set up my boards with hot dogs and chili and root beer, you know. And I went to pay my rent, and there was a Chinaman on the hotel. They were afraid to take the money. I said, where'd you get this money? You must have stolen. So my boy said, no, man, he won first prize singing. Say, him sing? Well, I still had some of my scars from the fight game, you know. But anyway, I paid off, you know. And I bought a couple of secondhand suits, and I got a telephone director. And I started calling all the theaters who had amateur nights. And I started winning first, second, third prizes, you know. And I
was this there. Is in L.A., right?
In L.A. This is 1946. It's 1946.
So what can you tell us about his childhood?
Well, his mother was an Algonquin Indian, and as I say, Roy was born in Kinder. His father was a bricklayer and a plasterer, so very much working class. But Roy told me that his first introduction was through gospel music, which was encouraged by his mother. And I think that's very interesting because that accounts for a lot of the soulfulness that I think we associate with Roy Brown. So it was those gospel roots that were very important.
How did he develop into being like a singer outside the church singing?
One of his favorite singers was, in fact, Bing Crosby. So once Roy discovered that he had a good voice, that, you know, Crosby was an early hero. Starting off trying to be a boxer, a prize-fighting boxer, but that didn't work out. And his career really started in Los Angeles in 1945 when he won an amateur talent show. And that opened the doors for him to come back towards the South. He played in Shreveport, Louisiana, and then had a long club residency in Galveston, Texas. And it was at Galveston where he made his first record, Deep Sea Diver, for Gold Star Records, run by a guy called Bill Quinn out of Houston, Texas. But that record meant very little. And it wasn't until he came to New Orleans that his recording career really took off.
Roy Brown wrote Good Rockin' Tonight. Can you tell us a little background about how he wrote that song?
Yes. Roy always said that the song was pitched to Wynonie Harris, who, as we know, was a very popular artist for King at the time. And but, of course, Wynonie was a big star. Roy was just making the grade. And basically, Wynonie just turned his back on him. In fact, on Good Rockin' Tonight, which perhaps I can just read out quickly, Roy said, I originally wrote Good Rockin' Tonight in Galveston. I really don't know what the inspiration of the song was. Words started forming in my mind and melodies. He said, all of my notes are formed in my mind. It's just a talent, I guess. I can't explain it. Anyway, the Good Rockin' Tonight, it just came to me, and I thought it's quite funny because it had Deacon Jones, Elder Brown, and Fanny Brown, and all that stuff in it. So that was Roy's take on Good Rockin' Tonight, which turned out to be, yeah, some people say it was the first ever rock and roll record, which is a debate, which is forever debatable. But the point about Good Rockin' Tonight was it was recorded at Cosmo Matassa's J&M Studio in New Orleans in 1947. And it's really, it was almost a relic of the swing band era, coupled with a boogie woogie was very popular at the time as well. So it's almost swing band joins boogie woogie. And it just had that joyful rocking sound, which was, if you like, the precursor of rock and roll music.
Oh, well, I heard the news. There's good rockin' tonight. I'm gonna hold my baby tight as I can. Tonight she'll know I'm a mighty, mighty man. I heard the news. There's good rockin' tonight.
Hi, let's rock tonight. Hi, let's rock tonight. Everybody, everybody, let's rock. 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 Now clap hands. Everybody, everybody, let's rock. Rock me, rock. Come on, rock. Rock me, rock.
Well, most people know that song as an Elvis Presley song.
Well, first of all, Wynonie Harris rejected the song. But as soon as Roy recorded it, I think he could see the merits of it. And then he recorded it for King in 1948 and had a number one R&B song out of it. And I have to say that Wynonie's version is just terrific. You know, the whole production and the slick sound, it's far better than Roy's version. Roy's song made number 13 R&B in June 1948. It's like it was a minor hit, it was a jukebox hit.
I heard the news, there's blues rocking tonight.
Elvis, when he came on the scene and started mixing up rhythm and blues and made rockabilly for Sun Records in 1954, almost turned Good Rockin' Tonight into almost a country song in a sense. But I think the key to it was the song's title. It's going to be Good Rockin' Tonight, which was perfect for the oncoming rock and roll era. And Elvis did it just with Bill Black on bass and Scotty Moore on guitar. And it was a sound that was quite unique at the time. As I say, it merged R&B and hillbilly music. And bear in mind that it was about 6-7 years after Roy had first made the record, and so it was quite clear that the treatment would be different. But Good Rockin' Tonight was perfect for the rock and roll era.
Well, I heard the news, that's good to rockin' tonight. Well, I heard the news, that's good to rockin' tonight. I'm gonna hold my baby as tight as I can. Tonight she'll know I'm a mighty, mighty man. I heard the news, there's good to rockin' tonight. I say, oh, meet me in a hurry behind the barn. Don't you be afraid that I'll do you no harm. I want you to bring along my rockin' shoes, cause tonight I'm going to rock away all the blues. I heard the news, there's good to rockin' tonight.
When you talked to Roy Brown, did he talk much about Elvis's version?
I didn't go into any depth, but I do know that he was very fond of Elvis, and certainly when Roy was having hard times in the late 1950s, the story is that when he was in late 50s, around about 1960, Elvis did actually help Roy out by giving him some money, which I guess he didn't have to do, but it was out of respect for Roy being a top artist who was on the downward spiral. So I know that Roy was very, very fond of Elvis.
Can you tell us how Roy Brown got a record deal? Was that his big break?
Roy was singing the song in a New Orleans club, and he was overheard by Cecil Gant, who had had a huge hit record around about 1944-45, a song called I Wonder. And Cecil was still a star of sorts and had some influence. And he recommended Roy to Deluxe Records, which was an independent record label out of Linden, New Jersey, owned by David and Jules Braun. And the Braun brothers realized that there was a lot of untapped talent in New Orleans, and so they made the trip south, and among the artists they recorded were Paul Gayton, who really had one of the first hit records on Deluxe out of New Orleans called True. So Roy was one of the first New Orleans artist to be recorded by Deluxe. And of course, he had a great song, and it was a song as much as anything which appealed to the Braun brothers. And it became a hit. As I say, it was a minor hit of sorts, but it was a hit. And that really opened the doors for him.
Now, I guess his really a big hit for Roy Brown was Long After Midnight.
Yes, that was a number one record right at the end of 1948.
Oh, long about midnight, when you feel the world has turned you down. Yes, long about midnight, when you feel the world has turned you down.
It's hard to say really why it was such a big hit, because, you know, to me it didn't have the, if you like, the hit qualities of Good Rockin' Tonight. But I guess what had happened was that Good Rockin' Tonight had paved the way, if you like, sorry, Long About Midnight. So that was the next step upwards. And that then started, if you like, a trilogy of Midnight records. You know, he then followed it up with Rocking at Midnight, and then he had Boogie at Midnight. So I suppose you could say that he milked a good thing with that Midnight theme.
49 was a really big year for him. Didn't he have three records simultaneously on the charts at the same time?
Did. That was round about spring when he had Rockin' at Midnight, he had Miss Fanny Brown, and then Deluxe reissued Good Rockin' Tonight, and that became a hit all over again, a number 11 hit. So he had those three records in the charts at the same time. In 1949, he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 records in the charts. So he really did consolidate his start with Good Rockin' Tonight and then Long About Midnight. And that was really a peak, but it was the peak year for him.
So how popular did he get? Can you give us a sense of where he was playing at, what his audience was?
Of course, at that time, rhythm and blues was totally a segregated market. So he would be playing theater chain like the Apollo in New York, in Harlem, the Howard Theater in Washington, the Royal in Baltimore, the Earl in Philadelphia. So this was, if you like, the acknowledged theater chain for leading black acts. But he did play at a lot of supper clubs throughout the whole South. And you could say that in effect, he was a leading artist in what's known now as the Chitlin Circuit. But it wasn't low-class juke joints by any means. It was very sophisticated supper clubs, but the audience was purely black.
And how were people being exposed to his music? How would you hear Roy Brown in 1949?
You would hear it through the radio. Disc jockeys were starting to come into prominence. But I guess a lot of his sales were actually to the jukebox operators. And so the jukebox was a great promotional tool. So you can imagine that a lot of the jukeboxes were filled with Roy's records. And then the record shop fell into that system.
Was he a pretty well-paid artist?
Well, being a top-selling recording artist, he would have commanded a good fee. But I'm afraid that sort of information, the actual amounts, same as the actual sales of records, is one aspect very, very poorly documented. So one could say safely that Roy was in the Cadillac class, and he had all the trimmings of a star artist. well dressed and had the women, but it's impossible to put figures on his stardom, but he was a big success.
I heard a story about Roy Brown and Wynonna Harris that they each had their own cars and they were beating up their cars or something like that. Did you ever hear this story?
I don't know about that one, but yes, artists would have their, I'd say that they'd be in the Cadillac class and they would have their band buses. And of course, Roy always had a good band with him. Being based in New Orleans, he was able to pick up some of the best New Orleans musicians. And I think that was another key to his success, that he was able to replicate his recorded sound on stage through these very good musicians. And in fact, Roy, one of his later band members, Al Reed, told me that he played with Roy in 1956, and the band had to be well dressed, and if they weren't, then they would be fined and so on. So Roy was a very proud man and carried his stardom well.
In your research, you find out, like, how was he dressed on stage, like how he was as a performer?
He had a very good act. I saw him in London in the late 1970s, and even though it's way after his hit period, his voice was still in good tact. And as I say, he was very well dressed and he had excellent stage presence, so he was able to command an audience. I wouldn't say he was an extrovert, for example, extrovert dancer and stage moves and so on, but he certainly put on a good show. And as I say, he had this great stage presence, which is very important.
Could you describe his singing voice to somebody who might have never heard Roy Brown before?
Roy had a, I suppose you could say it's almost a falsetto. And in fact, he did tell me in the interview that he was a baritone. So the falsetto was very, if you like, in contrast to his natural baritone. But what it meant was that he was, through this falsetto voice, he was very expressive and had a very soulful sound. And I think that was a key to his vocals. In fact, you could say that he was almost the first singer of soul. And you know, the artists that he influenced in the 1950s, I think, is a true indication of his stature. And he, among these artists, were B.B. King, Bobby Blue Bland, Little Milton, and then onto the R&B side, Jackie Wilson, Clyde McFatter, Roy Hamilton, and so on. So, Roy's impact was picked up by many artists who became hit acts in their own right. And I think that makes Roy, to me, a great original, almost in the class of Sam Cooke was an original, Ray Charles was an original, and then B.B. King became an original. But Roy was there right at the beginning and influenced a lot of these guys. Very impressive.
Now, another song that he recorded was called Hard Luck Blues. That was a pretty big song for him, 1950.
Oh, it was a huge song. It came just at the right time. I suppose most of Roy's hits, certainly in that 49 period, were sort of upbeat, boogie-based titles. And Hard Luck Blues was right down in the alley. And that was, in fact, recorded at King with the Griffin Brothers Band, who came from Washington, D.C. And Roy said that the song was, he was thinking about his mother and the hard times she'd had. And, it was a very emotional song, and that emotion certainly came through in the actual record. And, yes, it was a huge number one R&B hit in 1950, and that gave Roy's career a further push. He also told me that it's also a song where his father wasn't particularly well respected by Roy. So it was very much, as I say, his mother, all the sympathy was for mother, and father obviously was not the best of fathers. And that really was the genesis of the song. That, more than any Roy Brown record, I think, just shows, you know, what a great soul singer he was, years ahead of anybody knowing that there was such a thing as soul music. So, very important record.
Well, rocks is my pillow. The cold ground is my bed. The highway is my home, so I might as well be dead. I'm walking and walking. Seems I have no place to go. I got one pair of shoes, don't even have a change of clothes. And this road I gotta travel is so muddy and cold. Well, I'm gonna get religion. So much trouble. Sometimes I could cry. I'm gonna find my mother's grave, follow the tombstone and die.
Is there any other songs from the early 50s that he recorded for Deluxe / King that you could point out which people should know about?
Well, I suppose it always boils down to the hits, doesn't it? But yes, the Deluxe King situation is interesting because Deluxe was an independent label out of Linden, New Jersey. And then they came upon hard times. They had a warehouse fire and so on. So the Braun brothers approached Sid Nathan at King to enter a distribution deal. This was round about 1949. But this distribution deal went sour, and the long and short of it was that Sid Nathan ended up with the Deluxe Masters. And the one artist that Sid was interested in was Roy Brown. And so Roy was then transferred from Deluxe to King. But I suppose a song that has lasted quite well is Love Don't Love Nobody. That was a number two hit in late 1950.
Well, talk about love, it's a dark old ship. Talk about love, I hate that name. Love don't love poor me at all. Love is the cause of my downfall. Love don't love nobody. Love don't love nobody. Love don't love nobody. Love is the devil, but it won't get me. Love is fine if it's on your side. Love did me wrong and how I cried. Love made babies put me down and
covers of smaller hits, Cadillac Baby, Big Town, Barroom Blues. But that was it, 1951. At the end of 51, Roy had no more hits. And what happened was that he had a massive falling out with Sid Nathan, and Sid's relatives, Ben Bart, the promoter, and Jack Pearl, the attorney. And when an artist has an argument with the record label boss, and you have the booking agency and the attorney linked closely to them, well, Roy didn't really stand a chance. And he always says that he was blackballed, but he did continue to record for King. But I guess his heart wasn't in it, and King certainly wasn't in it. They were off to the races with other artists, and Roy Brown was very much in the past.
Well, after King, he did some recording later in the 50s with Imperial Records. So can you talk a little bit about some of those recordings he did for that label?
Well, yes. Imperial Records was owned by Lou Chard out of Hollywood. At that time, Imperial was very, very hot with Fats Domino, who was being recorded by Dave Bartholomew in New Orleans. And Dave was always on the lookout for other artists to record. And Roy was out of contract with King, and Dave was aware of Roy's history, having Dave himself was a deluxe artist. And in fact, I spoke to Dave about Roy around about 1983, and he told me how Roy came to record for Imperial. But one of the things that Dave said to Roy was, he said, "Roy Brown, I think you ought to be a millionaire, but I don't think you are." And you know, to me, that really summed up what had happened to Roy's career at King. So Dave took him into the Cosmo recording studios in New Orleans, Governor Nichols Street, and I suppose you could almost say gave him a Fats Domino sound. Out of that liaison, there were two hit records. One was a very minor hit, Party Doll, which was the cover of Buddy Knox's number one hit. But the other record that did hit was Let the Four Winds Blow, which Fats Domino later recorded. But Roy had it was a top 30 Billboard pop hit, so it was quite a significant hit.
I like the way you walk. I like the way you talk. Let me hold your hand. Try to understand. I want a girl like you to tell my troubles to. Don't be afraid, you heard what I said. Have you heard the news? You I'd hate to lose. Come to my side, don't say goodbye. Let the four winds blow, let them blow, let them blow. From east to west, I love you the best. Let the four winds blow, let them blow, blow, blow. From east to west, I love you the best.
Roy recorded for Imperial for a period of about 15 months, but then had problems with the IRS, and Imperial were very frightened that this was going to mean that their books were going to be audited, and basically dropped Roy like a hot brick. And so that was the end of his Imperial career. But it did produce, as I say, those two hits. Is another very good record, which in fact Roy doesn't like at all. He thought it was almost Dave Bartholomew trying to give him a Little Richard sound, but it is considered to be a classic black rocker now, and that's Saturday Night.
Yahoo! On Saturday night, well, that's my night. I like to play till the break of day. Pull a ball of down till the sun goes down. On Saturday night, woo, that's my night. Gonna drink them down, gonna be a clown. Gonna dine and dance, gonna make romance. On Saturday night, woo, that's my night. I might have a fight, but that's all right. I don't live but once, gonna have my fun. On Saturday night, that's my night. I get so tight, high as a kite. I ain't going home, 'cause I love to roam.
So out of that liaison, yes, one top 30 record, Let the Four Winds Blow, and several other very enjoyable and worthwhile records. But then Roy went back to King, which is quite extraordinary, for a couple of sessions in 1959. And in fact, produced two very nice records. One was Good Looking and Foxy 2, and the other one was School Bell Rock. But they didn't hit. King were big with Bill Doggett's Honky Tonk, and James Brown was starting to come through. So I suppose Roy was old school to them.
So what did Roy Brown, what was he doing in the 60s?
After King in 1959, he recorded for Home of the Blues label, which was named after a record shop in Memphis, Tennessee. He made three or four very good records for Home of the Blues, and in fact, one of them is one of my favorites called Rocking All the Time.
Hey, Mr. Band Leader, strike up your band. Play something with the beat that my feet can understand. 'Cause I feel like rocking all the time. Well, I feel like a rocker, 'cause rocking is a hobby of mine. Well, now I feel so good, I feel so fine. I got nothing but rocking on my mind. I feel like rocking all the time. I feel like a rocker, 'cause rocking is a hobby of mine. Well, I'm a big red rooster, early to rise, to get together with the chicks and dig some jive. I feel like rocking all the time. I feel like a rocker, 'cause rocking is a hobby of mine. Well,
that Roy still had it, and he was backed by Willie Mitchell's band, and we all know that Willie became very influential in the soul era, not only with his own records but also producing Al Green. So Roy still had it, has still got it, but then he got into more legal problems, and he was in fact accused of impersonating another artist and getting money illegally through the telegraph system, and basically that was the end of his career. So he moved to Los Angeles and then became a door-to-door salesman for household products, and was also selling encyclopedias. But this was a period where a lot of the original jump blues singers were totally forgotten, and Roy was part of the crowd, so to speak. And you had these great artists like Charles Brown, Ivory Joe Hunter, and so on, whose music was out of sync. The favorite blues artists at the time were very much Chicago directed, so you had people like Little Walter, Muddy Waters, Jimmy Reed, and so on, and the jump blues singers just didn't get a look in. So he was happily married and had a lovely daughter, and he was earning his way as a household product salesman. But he did make occasional singles, and in fact he did record an album for Bluesway Records in the late 1960s. And then he was basically brought out of retirement by the great band leader Johnny Otis and featured at the Monterey Jazz Festival. That was 1970. And that was a turning point for Roy. Things were just bubbling along. As I say, I met him in 1975, did the interview. And I think, you know, by being published in Blues Unlimited, that put fresh focus on him. And then Jonas Bernholm of Route 66 Records in Sweden arranged with Roy for many of his Deluxe and King records to be reissued, which is perfectly legal under Swedish law. And Jonas paid him royalties. But not only that, but also arranged for Roy to come to Europe. And he was starting to be able to take pride in his great recorded history.
He died fairly young. What happened, and then how did you hear about his death?
Well, yes, it was in the midst of these European tours, and he died on May the 25th, 1981, in California. And as I understand it, it was a heart attack. He was aged 60 at the time, coming up for 61. Now, we all thought he was 55 because the way he'd exaggerated his birthday. But no, he was 60, which... I guess today that's no age, but even in 81, was still too young to go. And the great thing to my mind is that Roy was able to take pride in and know that his key records for Deluxe and King in particular were respected and acknowledged when he passed. And I think that's a very important tribute. And in fact, Johnny Otis, when I interviewed him when he came over to England in 72, described Roy. He said, and with his compatriots, he said, these men are national treasures and the way they've been treated is a national disgrace. Well, that was in 1972. I'm pleased to say that Roy did get some recognition towards the end of his life.
Why is Roy Brown important to music history?
Well, I think his importance is, first of all, he was one of the early rhythm and blues stars to break out in the post-war period. And rhythm and blues, as we know, was the precursor of rock and roll music. So he was right at the forefront. His song, Good Rocking Tonight, was a very important rhythm and blues record through Wynonie Harris and then became an important rockabilly stroke rock and roll record through Elvis Presley. But most of all, I think that Roy was the first singer of soul. And for that, you can't ask for more, can you? He was right there. He was the leader of the soul movement way before soul was even thought of.
King Records doesn't have the name value as, say, Chess or Sun or Stax. And I was wondering, why do you think that is?
I think very simply, when the reissue business was really accelerating in the 1970s and into the 1980s, or throughout the 1980s, King Records was not licensing any of their product to outside companies, certainly to overseas companies. And so what this meant was that there just wasn't any King product available for at least a decade and a half. I'm very pleased to say that that was rectified when King started licensing, which is now based in Nashville, Tennessee, started a license to Charlie Records in England and also Ace Records. And yes, I'm very pleased to say I was part of the Ace Records deal because I was working as a consultant with Ace and with fellow consultant Ray Topping. You know, we helped to negotiate the first deal. And I can remember going to the King Archives in Nashville. And it really was a thrill, you know, not only because of the King record history, but also to see that almost every master tape had been carefully preserved. And so you could have criticized King at the time for not doing licensing deals. They had done an exceptional job in storing the tapes. And so companies like Ace and, as I say, Charlie just before us, and then Rhino and so on, were able to make these great King reissues all from master tapes. And even in the period before tape came in, the acetate direct-to-disc recordings, the majority of those had been preserved by King, and they've been lovingly restored by Ace Records in London. And so, therefore, King Records, we've been able to enjoy the great music that King produced in the best sound possible.
I'm Tony Collins. As I was lucky enough to see Roy Brown twice, the first time was in 1978. At a small theatre in the centre of London. And well, I was thrilled to be able to see a man like Roy Brown, whose heyday had been 25 years before, and to see him looking so good. And his voice was still everything it had been in the 50s. It was with a good band. He was doing all his old numbers. It was one of those gigs that you leave with a big smile on your face, just feeling good about the world. Well, obviously, I never saw him in the 50s, but he sounded just as good as on those old records. And in 1981, I saw him at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. And, of course, New Orleans was his hometown, so that was a bit special. And I think it was the first time he'd returned to New Orleans for many, many years. It was a large, enthusiastic crowd. He did a great set. Hoped I'd get to see him many more times. And a week later, he was dead of a heart attack, which was truly shocking.
Was his set high energy?
I don't remember him moving around very much. I mean, the man had a great voice. I can't remember who the band was in New Orleans, but one thing about the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, the bands were always top-notch. So his voice was as good as ever. The band was top notch. It was as good as you could hope for. And sadly, that was probably his last ever performance.
You've been listening to a King Records special about Roy Brown. For more information on September's celebration of King Records in Cincinnati, please visit our website, wvxu.org. Technical support from Andy Balterman. Next week, join us for a special about Henry Glover's years at King Records. I'm Lee Hay.